From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. Before we begin, just a couple of legislative updates. After an approximately four-decade wait, Congress finally passed legislation to repeal the punitive and unfair government pension offset and windfall elimination provision. Minutes after midnight on Saturday morning, December 21st, the Senate passed H.R. 82 by an overwhelming 76-20 majority. The measure is now awaiting President Joseph Biden's signature to make it the law of the land. The government pension offset windfall elimination repeal has been a generational legislative priority for NAPS. In addition, an issue which should be of existential concern to the postal community is the incoming Trump administration's resurrection of postal privatization as a viable legislative and operational strategy to deal with the Postal Service's current financial woes and operational miscues. We will be discussing this issue of privatization on future Naps Chat episodes. Another matter which should be of interest to Naps Chat listeners and has relevance to next year's anticipated battle over postal privatization is the election of Jerry Connelly to succeed Jamie Raskin as the ranking Democrat on the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability by the House Democratic Caucus. Representative Raskin will become the ranking Democrat on Judiciary Committee. And the final legislative note, the Senate adjourned for the year without voting on President Biden's four nominees to the Postal Board of Governors. On December 19th, Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee member Jackie Rosen of Nevada moved that the Senate confirm the four Board of Governor nominees. Ranking Republican committee member Rand Paul of Kentucky, who will assume the chairmanship next year, objected, stating that he was reserving the nominations for President-elect Trump. As a result, Trump will be gifted the opportunity to nominate all four vacancies on the Postal Board of Governors. As mentioned previously, Trump's support of postal privatization during his first term in the White House, combined with his renewed interest in the issue, may inform his choice of who he will choose to be on the Board of Governors. Now to our guest, and this is a change of pace from what I just shared with you. As a special holiday gift to Naps Chat listeners, we will be exploring a holiday season-related topic today. To accomplish this, I am pleased to welcome a fellow podcaster to Naps Chat, Robert Wakefield. Robert is the president of Naps Middle Tennessee Branch 32. He retired from the Postal Service in 2020 after 35 years of service. In his retirement, Robert found a new calling in podcasting. He is the host of the Saturday Cup of Joe podcast, which is dedicated to EAS and Naps members, and he is also the co-host of Two Brothers, One Bible podcast, where he and his pastor explore faith and life through the Bible. Today, we will integrate these two callings, that is, the Postal Service and the holiday season. Welcome to Naps Chat, Robert.
Thanks so much, Bob. Appreciate you having me on. I really do appreciate you asking me, and let's do this thing.
Obviously, we are within the holiday season, or for in the postal world, it's in the peak mail season, and holiday greetings are quite pervasive in America. There are two aspects that I would like to explore with you out of the gate. First, Christmas cards. Could you talk a little bit about their history?
Yeah, it's the history of the Christmas card really tickles me to death. It actually started, the very first Christmas card actually came from a guy who had too many friends. That's about what it was. He was a socialite back in Victorian England, and his name was Sir Henry Cole. And Sir Henry Cole was an elite socialite. He had tons of friends, and that was his issue, is that he had so many people that were sending him Christmas letters, and that was what was considered being done at this time back in the holiday season of 1843. And so what happened was, it was considered impolite in Victorian times if you did not respond to every Christmas letter that you received. Well, being that he was so popular, he had to come up, you know, with an idea. He came up with an ingenious idea, really. He had a friend of his who was an artist, and he went to him. He says, okay, this is what I want to do. I want to have a family scene drawn out of the holidays, people enjoying a meal around the table. And on either side of that, I want you to draw helping the needy, helping the poor. So he drew this up. The Sir Cole went to a printer and printed up 1,000 of these cards. And what's funny about it to me is at the top of it, he wrote the word to and had a line drawn out. And then at the bottom of the card, he had from with a line drawn out. So he could just fill in, the name he was sending it to, and he could just put his name on it and then send it through the British Post. It's ingenious, really, if you think about it. And so that is what's been considered the very first Christmas card. And it said on the card, it said, a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year to you. So that was the very first one that was ever invented.
Now, we've come a long way from that, because I think when we come to the United States, Robert Hall, known as the founder of Hallmark Cards and American Greetings, which is actually owned by the Weiss family, a Jewish family, have sort of, this is their season. They're printing, you know, the successor of the postal cards now are postal, really like the bifold cards that we're familiar with today.
Right. They were the ones that really put the Hall, because their last name was Hall, I think, and then it became the Hallmark Corporation. And so, yeah, they were the ones that really created an industry, so to speak. The very first Christmas card, rather, is credited to a guy by the name of Louis Prang, who is a Prussian immigrant. He had a print shop near Boston, and his very first Christmas card came about 30 years after Sir Cole's did. And it was so different from his. It was just a painting of a flower that said Merry Christmas. So it was really interesting how the transformation of the Christmas card came about.
Yeah, Santa Claus did not make an appearance on the Christmas card for quite some time, apparently.
Apparently not. He did not make an appearance on any cards. Now, when the Christmas card industry really took off with Hallmark, there was a series of cards by Norman Rockwell that painted Santa Claus on a lot of those cards. It was really, really kind of cool.
Now, partnering with the Christmas card movement are holiday stamps. And when the first Christmas cards in Victorian England came about, it sort of coalesced with the penny post. But in the United States, we have this whole industry of designing holiday stamps, whether they be religious or non-religious Christmas stamps. We have Hanukkah stamps. We have Kwanzaa stamps. We have quite an industry selling paper. We have sort of developed religious and non-religious Christmas stamps. We have Hanukkah stamps. We have Kwanzaa stamps. Can you talk about the development of these holiday stamps?
Oh, absolutely. The holiday stamp, the Christmas stamp, was first introduced on November the 1st, 1962. Now, that was a pivotal year, because on November 17th of 1962, I was born. So it's 62 years old. I can tell you that for a fact. So the very first Christmas stamp depicted a holiday wreath with a couple of candles. And what's neat about that is that they designed this stamp. They only printed 350 million of them. They thought, well, that will be plenty. We won't need any more than 350 million. It was a 4-cent stamp, and they grossly underestimated that. They ended up having to go to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, and they ended up printing and distributing over 1 billion of these stamps back in 1962. That's how popular the Christmas stamp was. And so the Christmas stamp went on from there. They introduced in 1970 the contemporary Christmas stamp, which the original ones were always taken from the National Art Gallery, of a picture of, you know, Jesus and Mother Mary. But these stamps featured, you know, secular themes such as Santa Claus or a reindeer. snowmen or any kind of winter scene. So that's kind of how that went. So it was in 1970 when that was introduced. And then in the Hanukkah stamps were introduced, the very first one was introduced in 1996. And those stamps typically have a menorah or other symbols that are, you know, associated with the Jewish Festival of Lights. So that's what that stamp was. And then it's a year later, the Kwanzaa stamps came out. So the Postal Service got a hold of this idea that stamps during this time of year could really be a big seller for them. And people wanted them. And so they would request those stamps. So that's an interesting story of how they got started.
Yeah, the industry with regard to the holiday cards, like Hallmark and American Greetings, they developed an industry, the Greeting Cards Association, which is very strongly supportive of these specific stamps because it's a partner. The greeting card industry and the development of holiday stamps seem to sort of be a symbiotic relationship.
You certainly get that. You got that right, Bob. It seems that it's a partnership with the card company. If we could develop, if the Postal Service could develop a stamp that people would want to put on their Christmas cards, that's a marriage made in heaven.
Yeah.
So it's just a great partnership between those two.
Now, I want to go back a little bit farther in time. Greetings and letters during biblical times, that is the time of the first Christmas. Was there letter writing, and how was it done?
Well, there was letter writing back then. The Persians back in those days, they had a mail courier service that was basically for kings or people of authority. They had a postal service that was in place. It wasn't door-to-door like we have here in the United States. But the Book of Esther even describes how that system works because it talks about the Mordecai. Esther chapter 8, verse 10, and it talks about that he would send written documents by hand of the couriers on horses, riding post horses used in the royal service, sons of speedy mares. Now, private mail was usually not done that way. If you were going to write a letter such as the Apostle Paul did, and most of his letters were written in prison, and so he would have someone who was going to another country or going to another church, and he would have this letter to be read at that church. And he would oftentimes dictate the letter to a scribe who would write all of it down. And then, like in 1 Corinthians, at the end of 1 Corinthians, he writes, "I'm writing this in my own handwriting, Paul." So it was very different back then what they were doing as far as sending mail or any kind of thing like that. It was just a completely different time.
Interestingly, the real ancient letter writing, and that is probably pre the first Christmas. I mean, there were, I believe in the Old Testament, there were around 79 specific references to letters written by the ancient Israelites, whether it be the time of Joshua or King David and so forth. And they were basically military correspondence or commercial correspondence, but it wasn't written on parchment or papyrus or animal hide. It wouldn't survive the test of time. A lot of these messages that were sent were on pieces of pottery written in some type of ink.
Right.
What do you make of that? I mean, imagine the postal system sending pieces of ceramic through the mail today.
that would be a cause for concern, wouldn't it? But you're right. They would write it on. They would write it on this pottery. There's actually been some archaeological discoveries of ancient pottery having this writing on it. And one of the ones that was called, I forget the name of it, but it was actually a military man who wrote on this pottery. And they found several pieces of it that they could piece together, and he was actually complaining that he did not receive the kind of messaging that he needed to carry out a command from the king. So it's really interesting how they would write, you know, because parchment paper wasn't that prevalent then, and parchment, I would assume, was been very expensive. But it's interesting that they found a way to get their message out on pottery if that's what they had to do.
What's also interesting is that there was this letter writing that was going on in biblical times seem to lead us to the conclusion that the residents in biblical time tended to be literate, because letter writing and literacy go hand in hand.
That's exactly right. And I think that archaeologists are starting to change their minds about this because of the evidence they found. That it's just very common to think that back in those days that people weren't educated and they weren't writing. But that's not necessarily the case, because Moses instructed the Israelites to write a letter of divorcement. Well, if you're going to write a letter of divorce, you've got to know how to write. And of course, there were other things that he would say, that you to write the Ten Commandments and place it in your home. So writing seemed to be more of a Hebrew type thing than most people have thought about in the past.
Now, by the time of the Christian Gospels, the nature of letter writing changed due to the nature of its content and its audience. Can you talk a bit about that?
It changed from the standpoint of these letter writings were taking place, many of them by the Apostle Paul, and he wrote them while he was in prison. And what was interesting about that is that the structure of letters was different. They would send their greetings to individual people at the end of the letter instead of the beginning of the letter, like we tend to do when we send letters today. How's so-and-so, and tell so-and-so I said hello. They would tend to do that at the end of their letters instead of the beginning. Sending these letters were not through any kind of postal system per se. It was that if you were going to a church in a city such as Corinth, you would send that with some of your disciples that were with you. So letter writing was very different back then, and yet these letters still, you know, got to where they were going, and they were read in churches all across Asia. So it was just a different way to get that messaging out that that they took advantage of.
It sort of harkens back to the beginnings of our republic, where a lot of letter writing was meant to be read publicly. Sort of spreading the news. It was like the way in which we spread the news were through letter writing. And so you would have a representative reading one of these letters from one of the apostles publicly in order to spread the religious doctrine or religious belief of those who wrote those letters.
Exactly. And that was more of an expedient thing, I think, than anything else. Can you imagine writing the book of Corinthians to every member of that particular church? No, they would write one letter, and that letter would go to them, and they during a worship service or a time that they came together, it would be read to the entire congregation at one time. And then they would take that letter and they would send it to another church, and it would be read to that church all at one time. It was more of an open letter type thing instead of personal correspondence. Although, you know, personal correspondence took place. You've got the book of Timothy, for example, that Paul wrote that to Timothy, but it was shared with the churches in where that Timothy was. So it was a different way of doing things. It really was.
Interestingly, the evolution of the letter writing as we come to early America, colonial America, some of the most famous letters that had been published were personal letters between John Adams, as was in the First and Second Continental Congress and around the time of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and his wife Abigail Adams, they were prolific letter writers that we now are coming to understand and read, I think, more carefully on that type of letter writing.
Right, and that's a perfect example, Bob, of how letter writing went from the biblical times to where it was a more personal time when the post office department was first being formed, how you could actually write these letters to a loved one and express that stuff. And it's kind of what we do with Christmas cards today. We send those to our friends, our loved ones, and what have you. So the letter writing thing really has transformed from biblical times to today's times. And of course, we don't write letters near like we used to. We just send an email.
Yeah, let me talk about the quality of letter writing via email or X or Twitter or Instagram or TikTok communications? Qualitatively, how's that different, the letter writing that you and I grew up with, or some of the earliest people in our country?
Well, it's changed from the standpoint of content, I think. One of the things about a text message is you can send K, and that means okay. You know, before when you and I grew up, we would write, "Dear so and so." You had your introduction, you had your body of your letter, you had your closing, you had your signature. It was actually a format that you followed. And today, when you write an email or text message or whatever, your format does not matter. You just got to get the message out there in a lot of ways. So I think we've lost something by not sending letters and cards like we used to. I think we've lost a part of society that we'll never get back.
So let me bring this full circle now, and my final question. So let's return to contemporary holiday greetings cards. How important are these greeting cards that we may send out to binding our nation together, which is the reason that the Postal Service exists in our heritage, and that's the legacy of the Postal Service. But more importantly, that how do holiday greetings and greeting cards bring families together?
I think one of the things that I've noticed, Bob, is that when you send a greeting card to anyone, whether it's a holiday greeting card or a get well card, there's just something personal about opening that letter. There's something personal about opening the envelope, taking out the card, seeing who it's from, and reading what it says. There's just a connection there that binds the nation together, like you said. That's unlike anything else. How many times do we see an email in our inbox and we don't even read it? But yet, if you get a personal card from a family member, you're going to open that up and see what they have to say.
And display it. I would just say interrupt and display it.
Right. Display it. Absolutely. You put those cards on your mantle, and we've got several cards. I've got several cards from NAPS national officers that I really do appreciate. They took the time to send that out, which I think that's what binds the nation together, is family to family.
Well, Robert, that'll be the last word for today, and I want to thank you for being our guest on the NAPS Chat. This has been Robert Wakefield, president of NAPS Branch 32 from Tennessee and host of Cup of Saturday Joe podcast. Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Thanks so much, Bob. I really do appreciate it.
And I want to thank NAPS Chat listeners for logging on. If you enjoy NAPS Chat, please leave us a positive review on your preferred podcast platform. And more importantly, share NAPS Chat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, have a joyous holiday season, and we'll be back to you in 2025.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe.